the studios of KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is Uprising, and I'm Sonali Kohatkar. It's Friday, September 4th, 2015. As the world is haunted by the images of a three-year-old Syrian boy's body, we'll turn today to acclaimed journalist Robert Fisk, Middle East correspondent for The Independent. And Joe Plummer, an attorney for the White Earth Band of Ojibwa, joins us to discuss how members of his community are challenging an 1855 U.S. treaty. Plus, as a week of events with President Obama in Alaska wraps up, we'll go to Anchorage to speak with Indigenous activist Faith Gemmill to discuss climate change and more. That's coming up after the news. Joining us now to analyze today's headlines is Christina Mislan. She's an assistant professor of journalism studies at the Missouri School of Journalism. Hi, Christina.
Hello, Sonali.
Secret documents obtained by a journalist have revealed significant Western responsibility for civilian casualties in Syria and Iraq. Earlier this year, a coalition of nations, including the U.S., Canada, France, Australia, and others, began bombing Syria and Iraq, citing the Islamic State as a target. But documents obtained through the Freedom of Information Act by Joseph Trevithick for an online website found accusations of hundreds of civilian killings over thousands of airstrikes since May of this year. The coalition has only admitted to killing two people. More than a dozen cases were self-reported by the coalition but not properly followed up on and kept secret. The 14-page document has been published at airwars.org. And the documents are embarrassing for Western partners who are also faced this week with an influx of refugees from the countries they're bombing and have been accused by many of not taking in enough refugees. Well, Christina, what do you make of these documents? During President Obama's tenure, people seemed less interested in the casualties of our wars, but clearly we're still killing people with our bombs.
Right. So, we've been talking months about this refugee crisis in Europe. And, you know, I think what the documents show is evidence, right, that there's a link here. And so often when we've been talking about the refugee crisis, for instance, the mainstream media, they talk about this issue kind of out of this context, right? It becomes just an issue about immigration, but it doesn't kind of take into context the actual issue of foreign policy, right? And military intervention. So what we have here is really an accumulation of years of violence, right? We've been talking about the U.S. doing drone programs and airstrikes, and not just the U.S., but many other countries as well. And we've been talking about the killing of even American citizens overseas and non-American citizens overseas, because it really shouldn't matter which country they're citizens of. So what we're looking at is evidence that says, you know, this isn't just ISIS violence, right? This is violence stemming from military interventions and occupations as well, and is directly linked to this crisis. So only can that crisis be really kind of talked about in an important and meaningful way once we bring this into the conversation.
Here in the United States, the new poster child of homophobia, Kentucky clerk Kim Davis, was arrested yesterday for contempt of court. She spent the night in jail. Ms. Davis was in the spotlight this week for defying the United States Supreme Court and refusing to issue marriage licenses to gay couples, saying it violated her religious beliefs. Now, Davis has also become a GOP darling. Senator Ted Cruz announced, quote, "Today, for the first time ever, the government arrested a Christian woman for living according to her faith. This is wrong. This is not America," end of quote. Conservative libertarian Rand Paul joined in as well. The Kentucky senator said, "I think it's absurd to put someone in jail for exercising their religious liberty." Meanwhile, at Rowan County Courthouse, where the drama played out all week, Davis's deputy clerk, Brian Mason, began issuing marriage licenses this morning. Well, Christina, how do you respond to the argument of religious liberty as a reason why someone won't do the job they're hired to do and told that they have to do by the Supreme Court?
Well, I think we should welcome this clerk to the many others who have also been imprisoned for their, you know, religious beliefs and expressions. But look, you know, these are the same people that would quote from one of our so-called founding fathers, right? So this idea of separation of church from state, or between church and state. So I think that's important to echo here. This establishment obviously has been debated since Jefferson wrote it. But what I think is interesting, so you have this clerk, yes, of course she can exercise her religious belief, but the idea that she shouldn't have to do her job, which is directly tied to the state, is absolutely absurd. So what if we turned it around? What if we asked a clerk who identified as, for instance, an atheist, refused to marry a Christian couple? We would be having an issue of, you know, not marrying heterosexual couples, right? And so freedom of religion, of course, religious expression doesn't translate into oppressing other human beings because you don't agree with their lifestyle. Mm-hmm. Sexuality isn't something that should be relegated by the legal system. Mm-hmm. So what I think is she has the freedom to do something else. She has the freedom also to quit.
And finally, as the presidential campaign continues to heat up, Republicans seem to have a new target in sight, and it was only a matter of time. Candidates like Senator Ted Cruz and Scott Walker have in recent days been tying Black Lives Matter to what they call an anti-police culture that they also blame President Obama for. The Guardian newspaper reported this morning that Republican candidates have been testing new messages with various subtle edges and abilities to cut. Much less subtle than their attacks are those by right-wing shock jocks such as Bill O'Reilly and Rush Limbaugh. O'Reilly in particular has been taking aim at Black Lives Matter multiple times during his shows, saying things like, quote, every time there's a controversy about an officer shooting a black person, they're out there stirring the pot. Various Fox News hosts have called Black Lives Matter, quote, a murder movement and even a hate group. Well, Christina, I suppose we shouldn't be surprised at the overt racism of right-wing conservatives, but still it's cringe-inducing to hear the things that they say that they think are okay to say out loud. What do you think?
Well, yes, definitely. It's hard to listen to, and we shouldn't be surprised. But I will say that I'm glad it's being said. And the reason why I say that is that I often, you know, we're seeing what these candidates are representing. We're seeing what's going on in their minds, right? So we can start to really have a conversation about who do we want to run this country? Do we want these racist right-wing conservatives, or do we want someone more progressive that's actually going to support Black Lives Matter movement, right, and not use them as a way to tap into this white resentment that happens, right, or the white imagination, as some scholars would call it. So if some of these candidates want to use the Richard Nixon way of, you know, kind of constructing their political campaigns, I say, well, you know, bring it, right, do it. And so then we can have a Hillary Clinton, or even better, Bernie Sanders, actually have some real kind of substance when we actually talk about the debates.
Christina, thanks as always for joining us. We'll talk to you again next week.
Thank you.
Christina Mislan is an assistant professor of journalism studies at the Missouri School of Journalism. This is Uprising. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. The story of how 3-year-old Alan Kurdi came to drown and have his body wash up on the shore of a Turkish resort town has generated worldwide grief. The Syrian Kurdish toddler and his family were fleeing violence from Kobani, a Syrian border town with Turkey that has been overrun by the Islamic State in Syria and Iraq, or ISIS, several times. The family's asylum application to Canada was apparently denied. According to the BBC, quote, the UN wouldn't register the family as refugees, and because they were unregistered, the Turkish government would not grant them exit visas. Eventually, that led them to board a boat and pay a Turkish smuggler more than $5,000 to head toward Europe. When harsh weather hit the boat, the family was thrown overboard, and without proper life vests, Alan and his brother Ghalib and their mother, Rihanna, died. The only remaining family member was the father, Abdullah Kurdi, who told his story to the media yesterday. The photos of Alan's little body washed up on shore were unbearably difficult to view. Today we turn to a guest who has chosen a career where he has had to view countless dead children's bodies. Robert Fisk is a multiple award-winning journalist and war reporter and the Middle East correspondent for The Independent. He holds more British and international journalism awards than any other foreign correspondent. He's been voted British International Journalist of the Year award seven times. And among his most notable work are the three interviews he conducted with Osama bin Laden in the 1990s. He now joins me on the phone from Lebanon. Robert, when we hear the story of what happened to the Syrian boy that the world is now shocked by, first tell us how typical his story is for Syrian refugees today.
Well, I think it's more typical than we realize. You've got to understand that over the past few years, there's been a very heavy photographic censorship of this terrifying and tragic story. Over and over again on television stations, particularly in the West, whenever a dead person, a woman, a child, has been seen on the television screen, the sort of a television techie dictators blob the face. They effectively erase the face of the dead person, so they become a thing, so that you don't associate them with someone who has just been alive and is now dead. You see the same sort of tactic being used, for example, over dead babies in Gaza when they died in the Israeli bombardment of Gaza. The face was blotted out so that the face, perhaps, which was perfectly untouched, looking like a little angel, suddenly you cannot see it. And what was remarkable about the little boy on the beach, perhaps because his face was looking downwards into the sand, you didn't see his eyes, it was just thought acceptable to show this photograph with all the usual health warnings, you know, and many people, of course, have seen dead bodies in their lives, with all the usual health warnings. And therefore, of course, suddenly people took notice. This really was a little boy, not a body with its face erased by, you know, the mark of approval or disapproval of the television blobber, as I always call them. So in a sense, it was very typical. What was unusual was that somehow the effect of this child lying on the ground, a martyr to our indifference, if you wish, got through without anyone tampering with the picture. That was what struck me immediately I saw it, because, you know, in my job in the Middle East over the last almost 40 years, I've seen so many dead children. And whenever I've seen their photographs printed, the photographs have been tampered with so that you can't see the face or the eyes or the wounds. And here was, of course, this was a child who had died in one piece. It was sort of acceptable for the audience. It didn't make them reel back in horror. It made them horrified with anguish and empathy, which is a different thing altogether.
Now, how directly is European foreign policy linked to the force that is driving Syrians out of their country?
Well, first of all, I'm not sure European foreign policy exists as such. It's a series of different foreign policies that pretend to be European. You know, the problem is we don't have a foreign policy at all. First of all, remember, we hated Bashar al-Assad, the president of Syria, a horrible dictator whom we wanted to overthrow. At one point, Obama and the British were going to bomb him. Then suddenly, it turned out that the British and American people didn't want to get involved in another war in the Middle East. So instead, we bombed his rebel enemies, in particular ISIS, principally because they'd been killing Westerners as opposed to killing Arab Muslims, which they'd been doing for a very long time already. And because of this, we've now got a situation where, having gambled away our policies in the Middle East, backing dictators who did what we wanted and not backing dictators who didn't do what we wanted, we've ended up in a situation where much of the Middle East, and it's not entirely our fault after all, but much of the Middle East is now a hell disaster for those who live there. And, I mean, you know, it's easy to take a sort of straightforward saying, well, you know, we've got to look after all these people. It's noticeable, of course, that the hundreds of thousands of Muslim refugees, most of them Syrian, are not heading to the Ummah, the center of the Islamic world. They're not rushing to the shores of Saudi Arabia and pleading with Saudi policemen to take the train to Riyadh. They're coming to Europe because at the end of the day, I think they know that our humanist philosophy is likely to be kinder to them than that of the Arab kings and dictators who rule over them. But having said that, we in the West bear a heavy burden of responsibility for these people. The grinding power of extremism and brutality in the Salafist mode, which we see in ISIS, which, of course, is effectively also a Saudi idea, is something that we started when we invaded Iraq in 2003. We never saw people being beheaded until we occupied Iraq. And remember, the ISIS didn't exist then, but people being beheaded and garrotted on the screen was something that was there. We didn't show it on television, but we saw it in Iraq. It existed. So it was the opposition to Western occupation and suppression within the Islamic world that began this series of horror movements, if you like, which now afflict the people there much more than they do us, after all, although they do kill us as well. and which brought about, at the end of the day, these biblical epics of suffering, which we're now seeing in this vast number of people sweeping across from the Middle East into the European continent.
Now, how important is it for people to see the brutality that is unleashed by war? The Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, or ISIS, relies on shocking people with their horrific images.
Well, there are booklets which have been written to advise groups like ISIS, also groups like Nusra, that to show and demonstrate the most brutal terror in the most brutal and clear-cut technological way, i.e. with videotapes, is a method of breaking the will of your enemies. So, for example, it was very interesting. I was talking to a minister in the Kuwaiti government after ISIS had released its disgraceful, shameful film of the burning to death, the cremation of the living Jordanian fighter pilot who was captured after he was on a bombing mission over Iraq and Syria. And the minister pointed out to me, and this is a minister who was also in charge of propaganda in the Kuwaiti government, he pointed out that he'd watched this piece of film, video footage of the killing of this man, over and over again. He said there were 7 different camera positions. It was that slickly and professionally made. Hollywood doesn't usually use 7 camera positions on a particular sequence in a movie. So you've got a people who, there's a brain behind ISIS, and terror in the most literal sense of the word, I find terrorists a pointless cliche now, but terror in the most literal sense of the word is there. You know, in the Middle Ages, we in Europe would chop off the heads of traitors and we would torture people to death in public in order that the public would be terrorized into obeying the king or the duke or the marquis or whoever it was. So the idea of using terror in this way, the terror was a word used, remember, about the French Revolution, where they were also chopping off even more heads than ISIS. There's nothing new about it. What's particularly sinister, I think, is the way in which they're now beginning to learn from mistakes. You see, at the beginning, ISIS would show a mass execution. There'd be 10 seconds of video, which 1 second would be shown, and that was it. Then they began to drag it out. Then they would say, well, here is the man we're going to execute today, and here's a look at the man who can talk to you, who will execute next week or the week after next. And we've seen the same thing now with the slow destruction of Palmyra, the great Roman city in the Syrian desert east of Homs, in eastern Syria, where ISIS captured the city of Palmyra. And everyone said, oh, my goodness, will they destroy this extraordinary Roman center, this magnificent, beautiful Roman city, which I've seen, like many millions of other people, I've been there. And first of all, nothing happened. Then there was a mass execution of Syrian soldiers in the old Roman amphitheater, but nobody touched the archaeology. Then the next thing that happened was that we saw videotape of explosives being strapped to Roman pillars. Then they murdered on film again, executed, beheaded, the former caretaker of the antiquities at Palmyra and chopped off his head and put his head at the bottom of his torso and even put his spectacles back on the face. There's terror for you. And then there was nothing again. And then we saw a still picture of the Bel Shemim temple being blown up, but no movie. And then later, people said, and the news agencies reported, but ISIS did not show the destruction of the Baal temple, the most recent one to be destroyed. So now they're slow motioning this out so that every week, we have a new event to show our horror at. And in this sense, you see, they are destroying the history of a people, they're destroying the future. But they're also, what we're not looking at in this, they're also doing something else. They're making a lot of money out of antiquities. My information, which in fact reached me yesterday from very close to Syria, is that what ISIS do is they sell antiquities, which they find in, say, Palmyra. And the money is paid over, and the antiquities are bought. And then the place where the antiquities were found, in the temple, is blown up, it's destroyed. Not because particularly they believe this is a temple to idolatry, although that's good enough propaganda and ideology, but because by blowing it up, they cover the evidence of the theft. No one, it can be proved, took this from this temple, because we don't know what's left of the temple. It's all been destroyed. So in this sense, the price of antiquities goes up, the international market in antiquities is more ready to buy, ISIS makes more money, and the world's heritage of Palmyra is destroyed at the same time. All this is going on, although if you look at it in the one-dimensional way that we are given it on, say, television in Europe or America, or indeed even in parts of the Middle East, it's the terror of ISIS driving people out. Remember, an awful lot, hundreds of thousands of people continue to live under ISIS rule in Iraq and Syria and are not fleeing for their lives. Why are they doing that? Are they finding that they can live with this, perhaps?
So, Robert Fisk, in terms of the mess that is unfolding in the Middle East, and I appreciate what you just did in laying out the way in which ISIS is operating, because we don't get that often enough, but our leaders in the West are just able to point to ISIS as being the problem. There's also Bashar al-Assad and the war that children like Alan Kurdi are fleeing. There are many people responsible for that. And as a journalist who's been there on the front lines, how do you explain what needs to happen now in order for Syrians to be able to remain in their own country and not fear for their lives?
Well, they're not going to be able to at the moment. And since we in the West are still sending men with weapons into Syria to fight, we are not the slightest bit interested in these people. We just wish they wouldn't come to Europe when they fled. That is the truth of the matter. The Americans are putting money aside and openly saying and stating that they are sending moderate, I quote, moderate, unquote, rebels to fight both ISIS and Assad. That's quite an ambitious undertaking. So far, three-quarters of the rebels they've sent over have been captured by an al-Qaeda affiliate, and their leader has apparently been executed. But they're sending the weapons over. Now, when you send weapons into a country, you will increase the violence, however much you think that your friends are going to fight the Assad regime or the ISIS regime or Nusra or whatever fantastic army you decide to combat. The truth of the matter is that from the very start, we got it wrong on Syria. We demanded the overthrow of Assad instead of saying Assad and the opposition must meet together and there must be a solution. Assad went along with this, knowing that we didn't want that. Now, that doesn't mean that Assad is a nice, benevolent dictator. He's a brutal man, and his torturers work full-time, as is the case and has been the case with every Arab dictator. But the fact of the matter is that we went after our own interests there. We were high on the idea of what we in the West called the Arab Spring. The Arabs largely didn't call it that. That was our invention. And we wanted to get rid of all these dictators and have these nice democracies, and then, of course, have excellent trade relations with them. And it all went wrong, not entirely our fault again. I think in Egypt, for example, there was a tremendous, appalling, flawed, painful social movement that effectively turned its back on the freedoms it won in the 2011 revolution that got rid of Mubarak. But, you know, we help to create by funding rebels, by funding armed groups, by sending weapons into these Middle Eastern countries, we create the circumstances of chaos. And from that chaos emerge the poor and huddled masses, and they head for Europe. And what do? We put up razor wire, we close our borders, we claim they're illegal immigrants, we claim that ISIS may be with them, that ISIS may be smuggling refugees into our countries to destroy us. I mean, you know, it's so preposterous. First of all, we complain that our own people are going to join ISIS, and then we complain that perhaps ISIS are sending their own people with the refugees. The fact of the matter that's coming out in Europe now, and I don't think this probably gets across in America, is that there is a growing number of hundreds of thousands of Europeans who feel and have felt long before the picture, you know, which we saw of poor Alan Kurdi, who felt enormous pity for these refugees and tried to help them. 20,000 Hungarians were on the streets protesting at their own government's failure to help the refugees. I was on, not many weeks ago, the Greek-Macedonian border, where Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders, were handing out food and water and medical equipment to refugees. And these, in many cases, you know, these were not armed ISIS men or people trying to smuggle themselves in. These were whole families in tears and pain. Many of the women had been badly burned by scalding themselves, making fires to cook on at night in the fields. The men, many of them, had bullet wounds and also had truncheon marks from European policemen who'd beaten them on the border. And, you know, I think the strange thing is going on in Europe now is that with the exception of Angela Merkel, who really is becoming the angel of Germany in the eyes of many ordinary, decent people, the politicians are not doing what the people would want them to do, which is to help these hundreds of thousands of poor people. And you're seeing this again and again. I mean, what is one to make, for example, of my own beloved Prime Minister, David Cameron, whose profession is actually a public relations man before he became a politician? David Cameron flew the British flag at half-mast to mark his mourning for the death of the King of Saudi Arabia a few months ago, a country which supported the Taliban, which supports Wahhabism and Sufism and all these extremists. Is he going to lower my flag, perhaps, for poor little three-year-old Aylan Kurdi? He should, but he won't, will he?
Well, that's an appropriate question to end on. My guest is Robert Fisk, a multiple award-winning journalist and war reporter and the Middle East correspondent for The Independent, joining us from Beirut, Lebanon. This is Uprising, and after this break, we will take a look at a couple of stories on how Native Americans are fighting for their rights and the planet. By the way, you can listen to my off-the-cuff reflections on the news and behind-the-scenes details about Uprising on my new podcast. It's called Uprising Uncut. Details are at uprisingwithsonali.com, or you can search for Uprising Uncut on iTunes. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. Members of the Ojibwa tribe in Minnesota are asserting their right to land and resources under a treaty that the U.S. signed in 1855. In the latest in an ongoing series of actions, community members recently harvested wild rice and fished in the Gull Lake area. Hoping to head off a legal conflict, the Minnesota Department of National Resources issued one-day permits to the activists, even though they had not applied for them. Leaders from the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwa tore the permits publicly and went ahead. They were then issued citations, which is what they wanted. The citations could result in misdemeanors, which would enable the tribe to pursue a court case to challenge the government on their right to use resources outside of the reservation area. One academic who's been studying the activism told Press the strategy for the state is you don't let it get to court because the tribes could win. The end game is to assert their treaty rights to stop the building of a massive $2.5 billion crude oil pipeline called Sandpiper, which is proposed to go through Minnesota. My guest is Joe Plummer. He is a tribal attorney for the White Earth Nation. Welcome to Uprising, Joe.
Thank you.
Now, can you tell us what exactly happened last week when there was one of the actions that has been going on for a while now, when people tried to fish and tried to pick wild rice? What was the interaction with the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources?
It was actually pretty peaceful, Sonali. I need to give you a little bit of background, though.
Yes.
Wild rice, I don't know whether you're familiar with it or your viewers are, but it grows naturally around our area, and this is the mother lode of it right where we live, up in the 1855 treaty area, which consists of present-day White Earth, Leech Lake, and Mille Lacs reservations. And the larger 1855 treaty area is a 13-million-acre area that the treaty signers, our ancestors, ceded land to the federal government, but there was no cession or no giving away or surrender of the usufructuary rights. Those are called gathering rights. The rights to fish and hunt and make maple sugar and gather medicines and most importantly, wild rice, which is a very essential to the Ojibwe people.
And so what you were saying, usufructuary, this is a legal term. It was a new word that I learned yesterday. It essentially means the right to use or enjoy a thing possessed directly and without altering it. So it's a limited right.
Yes, it's limited, but it's a very valuable right nonetheless. And it's our position that And it's also backed up by case law that we continue to enjoy these usufructuary rights in the larger ceded territory off the reservations. And taking that a step further, if we have the right to gather, we should have the right to make sure that the environment is as clean as it can be so it continues to produce these resources. Now, where we're located, we're also located up at the headwaters of the Mississippi, up at Lake Itasca, you know, where the Mississippi starts as a small creek and it meanders north. It goes north, and then it eventually starts to go south over by Lake Winnebogoshish, you know, on the Leech Lake Reservation. And so these waters are pretty pure waters. There's nothing up in this area to pollute them. And all of the surface waters and the groundwater are very close. There's lots of interaction between the surface waters and the groundwater. And the pipelines that are proposed to come through here are, this is an Enbridge project. Enbridge, as you may be aware, is a Canadian pipeline company out of Alberta. They have a large presence in Minnesota. They run literally 8 pipelines through what they call the Enbridge Main Line, which goes right through the Leech Lake Reservation entirely, goes through part of the Fond du Lac Reservation to the east over by Duluth. And it also goes completely through this 1855 treaty area. So it's our belief that we have the right to maintain the pureness of the water so they'll continue to produce the wild rice. The wild rice is, of course, like a canary. It's like a canary. If the rice is going to die, then everything else is going to die too. And we have evidence that the oil activities are a contrary, you know, to the wild rice. And so we've raised this through some state proceedings. The Public Utilities Commission here in Minnesota is engaged in a process to permit Enbridge's application to site not one but 2 new pipelines. One, the Sandpiper, but a new one is a reroute of one of these 8 mainline pipelines. But they want to run these 2 right through this area, the headwaters of the Mississippi, and right near one of the largest wild rice beds in the world, Lower Rice Lake on the White Earth Reservation. It's about 5 miles long by 1.5 miles wide, and it consistently produces abundant wild rice. And this is real natural wild rice. This isn't the paddy rice that people out in California probably get.
And so, Joe, this is sort of a, I really appreciate that background. So essentially, in order for some of the tribal communities to be able to say this pipeline cannot go through this pristine land, they're testing the waters of these usufructuary rights by gathering and harvesting and getting these citations that they got last week and hopefully going to court?
Well, actually, there were 4 people that I'm aware of, Sonali, who got. I was out at the Hole in the Day Lake last Friday, a week ago, and 2 ricers received citations, and there were also 2 fishermen who received citations because they threw a gill net in Gull Lake. Now, the significance of Hole in the Day Lake is that one of the chief signatories to the 1855 treaty between the United States and the Chippewa of the Mississippi, Winnebogoshish, and Pillagers was Hole in the Day. Hole in the Day's name is Buganagijik. It translates into Hole in the Day. And that lake is kind of named after where his former home was. And so we felt that that was significant to try to emphasize our point.
So the 1855 treaty, did that explicitly prohibit people from gathering resources? Because Minnesota, the state of Minnesota, thinks it does.
No, it doesn't. The 1855 treaty, Sonali, did not happen in a vacuum. The Chippewa we're a pretty large tribe up in northern Minnesota, Wisconsin, and northern Michigan. And there are literally 44 treaties between the United States and the Chippewa. So the 1855 treaty is one of the last in a long line of treaties with the federal government. And each of the promises are built on top of the prior ones. And you don't just take a look at the 1855 in a vacuum. You take a look at it in light of its history and its relationship with the other treaties, most significantly the 1854 treaty between the Chippewa of Lake Superior and the United States, of which all of these 1855 signatories were also parties, and they're only separated by 3 months. And in fact, the 1855 treaty between the Chippewa and the United States, actually called the Chippewa the Treaty of Washington, is known or referred to around our people who are familiar with treaties as an addendum to the 1854 treaty. So while there's no specific reservation of off-reservation gathering rights, most significantly, there's no explicit surrender of those rights, and that's the critical point.
Now, didn't the Supreme Court in 1999 rule that the Chippewa, including the White Earth Nation, retained those rights to gather and hunt, and then fish, rather, and harvest?
Well, actually, that was the Mille Lacs case, and one of the treaties that the United States Supreme Court interpreted in that litigation was this exact same Treaty of 1855 with the Chippewa. And what the United States Supreme Court said is, this treaty does nothing to negatively impact the existing usufructuary rights.
So how do we put this into the broader historical context of U.S. treaties with indigenous communities? Because, of course, this is a crucial aspect. The treaties between Native communities and tribes in the United States government is part of the history of the founding of this nation, and the very bloody founding of this nation.
Yep. In fact, Sonali, treaties, after they were negotiated out in the field between representatives of the United States and the Native people, were taken back to Washington and submitted to the United States Senate for ratification. And in fact, this 1855 treaty was ratified and has its own United States statute number. So this has the force of federal law.
So let's talk about the end game. Where would you like to see this head legally? Do you foresee or hope that with the actions that have been taking place in challenging the state of Minnesota, that eventually it will prevent the Canadian company Enbridge from running its pipeline, the Sandpiper pipeline, through Minnesota, as well as the reroute of the other pipeline you were talking about?
Well, that's part of our goal, you know, is to prevent the Sandpiper. In fact, we're actually a few steps before that, Sonali. What we're really in favor of is a responsible environmental impact statement, because the process that Minnesota has in place for permitting pipeline applications doesn't require nearly that in-depth level of environmental review. In fact, in Minnesota, the Department of Commerce, you know, which encourages activities like these pipelines and power lines, also includes the Public Utilities Commission, the supposedly objective body that determines whether or not the applicant, Enbridge, has satisfied its requirements according to the checklist of the permit application. So I guess the point I'm trying to make here is it seems pretty contradictory, a conflict of interest for one agency to have these very different roles.
So what's next, Joe, with what's happening in Minnesota? What do we need to look out for? Do you see the struggle as part of the broader broader struggle for environmental justice in the United States?
Definitely. I also want to let you know that in these Public Utilities Commission proceedings, we have several citizens groups who have organized, who are also parties to the proceedings, who have attorneys, and they're very well represented. And we join together as we complement each other in making these arguments. We're not making them just for us. We're the conscience up here. We're doing it for everybody. You know, if we're going to keep this environment clean, it's going to be clean for us and our future generations, but also for the non-Native people.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Joe, for joining us today. Give out a website where people can find out more.
You could probably look on Honor the Earth, maybe. Honor the Earth is another party in the Sandpiper litigation, and that would probably be a very a good start.
And we'll post whatever links we can find as well to our website, uprisingwithsonali.com. Thanks so much, Joe. Best of luck to you.
Okay, thank you, Sonali.
Joe Plummer is the tribal attorney for the White Earth Nation. This is Uprising, and we'll go from Minnesota after this break to Anchorage to take a look at what has been happening all week. President Obama just wrapped up a 3-day tour of Alaska, where Indigenous activists were out in full force. And we'll be joined by Faith Gemmel. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. President Obama just wrapped up a historic 3-day visit to Alaska, during which he made climate change a major focus. In Anchorage, he said climate change is no longer some far-off problem. It is happening here. It is happening now. We're not acting fast enough. I've come here today as the leader of the world's largest economy and its second largest emitter to say that the United States recognizes our role in creating the problem and we embrace our responsibility to help solve it, end of quote. There was great irony in the president's statements, given that just weeks ago, activists were outraged over his approval of Shell Oil's offshore oil exploration projects in Alaska's fragile Chukchi Sea. Well-known climate activist Bill McKibben slammed Obama, saying it's very difficult for Barack Obama or anybody else to say, look, we take this completely seriously. This is the greatest problem the world's ever faced, but it's okay to go ahead and start drilling a whole new oil field up in the Arctic. Those two things are at odds, said McKibben. Well, we go now live to Alaska to speak with Faith Gemmel. She is the executive director of the group Resisting Environmental Destruction on Indigenous Lands, or Red Oil. Welcome to Uprising, Faith.
Thank you for having me.
How important was President Obama's visit? I mean, before we get to the criticism of his hypocrisy, was it symbolically an important gesture for him to spend so much time in Alaska and to spend time with the Indigenous communities there?
Yes, it was very important that he came here because Alaska is ground zero of climate impacts and climate imbalance. We see changes on a regular basis here in Alaska, and we're hit twice as fast as everywhere else in the north. And so it was very important for Obama to come here to see for himself the impacts that Indigenous people see.
And among the places he visited was the island of Kivalina, which is literally submerging under rising sea levels. And scientists predict the island will simply disappear within 10 years. Can you tell us about Kivalina and how its residents are coping?
Kivalina is a small community in northwest Alaska that has been dealing with coastal sea ice loss and erosion of their lands, and they've been looking at relocation for a while. They were involved in a lawsuit with oil companies to try to hold the oil companies accountable because of climate impacts, which is caused by the burning of fossil fuels. And so the oil companies that operate here in Alaska should be responsible to relocate communities that are impacted by climate change. And unfortunately, they did not win their lawsuit. So they're still looking at relocation of the community. And that's what's happening here in Alaska right now. There's three communities that need to be relocated soon, and very little economic resources are being put towards these communities relocating.
Well, President Obama, during his week there, announced new investments in combating climate change and assisting remote Alaskan communities. He will announce a federal coordinator for building climate resilience in Alaska and a remote Alaskan communities energy efficiency competition and a city-led public-private partnership to achieve 99.7% clean energy on Kodiak Island. How do you respond to that? I mean, even if Alaska becomes, and communities in Alaska become energy efficient, it's not going to stop the waters from rising because climate change is a global phenomenon.
Actually, some of those communities that you just spoke of, they are already operating renewable energy sources. And I'm actually thankful that the president did make those commitments, because Alaska is in crisis. We are in climate crisis, and we need as much resources as possible now for the communities that are hit first, hit hardest by climate impacts. And we are capable here in the state of Alaska, even though we are a resource state, we are totally able now to begin to transition to clean energy projects. And so I was thankful that there was a commitment towards beginning to do that for the communities that need it the most. I'm thankful for that because we need it.
What about the drilling by Shell in the Chukchi Sea? Shell Oil has essentially received a permit to explore offshore drilling possibilities in a very pristine environment. If it does discover major oil reserves, the chances of a major oil spill are extremely high. And President Obama didn't seem to acknowledge the irony of him talking about climate change while approving this permit.
There was no discussion whatsoever about offshore development while he was here. And all the stories that I saw, the focus was on climate change. And one of the quotes that was taken by an environmental staff person was, that's fair because Alaska is a resource state and usually oil dominates the politics. But here in Alaska, I agree that the Chukchi Sea is critical to protect, because we at Red Oil, we stand in solidarity with Inupiat in opposing Shell's risky offshore plans to drill in the Chukchi Sea, because we want to promote and uplift and protect the subsistence rights of not only the Inupiat, but all Alaska Native communities when they're facing imposed development here in the north. And drilling offshore in the Chukchi Sea not only poses the risk of spills and the risk to the subsistence livelihood of the people, but it does exacerbate the current impacts of climate change. And we don't agree with the president's administration on the permits for drilling offshore in the Chukchi Sea.
Can you tell us about the rallies and the events and the activities that you participated in all week during President Obama's visit? What were some of the expressions from communities during the president's visit?
We held a rally downtown Anchorage on the day that Obama arrived here in Anchorage, and we titled it Our Climate, Our Future. It was put forward by grassroots Alaskan citizens, people, organizations to address the climate impacts in Alaska and basically send a message to the president that he needs to become more aware of what's really happening, that we are in an urgent situation here, and do the right thing, such as rescind the shell permits to drill in the Chukchi Sea, protect places like the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. And the rally was amazing. There was about 300 to 350 people there, which is really good for Alaska. And people came from all over to attend the rally. It was very powerful. We had music acts in between the speakers, and we had a diverse coalition of voices that were speaking at the rally. It was very powerful and very positive. There was also another rally by the Democrats to welcome the president. And I guess the media and the law enforcement thought that the rallies were going to be violent. They were prepared for that, but it was very peaceful and positive, and it was a nice sunny day, and we just sent a positive message to the president.
Faith, how important is it to link the environment and the preservation of natural resources to the preservation of indigenous culture? Indigenous culture, community, and language are all related to relationships with the earth, right?
Mm-hmm. Especially here in Alaska, because indigenous communities here in Alaska are very isolated. There's over 227 tribes in Alaska, and our communities are very isolated. There's not roads to very many communities. You have to fly in a small plane to get to our communities. And so we are highly dependent on the land to provide for our needs, our subsistence needs. And so we hunt, we gather, we fish to survive the harsh, cold winters here in Alaska. I come from a small community up north that's called Arctic Village. And we depend on the land to provide for our food sources. It's the land has to be intact to maintain and protect the food security of indigenous peoples in Alaska, like in the Chukchi Sea. The Chukchi Sea is home to several Arctic species. There's walrus, beluga whale, bowhead whale, seals. All of these resources in the Chukchi Sea provide subsistence needs for the communities that live on the coast. And as I said, in my community, we're very remote. We live from the caribou, the porcupine caribou herd. And the porcupine caribou herd gives birth to their young in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge coastal plain. And that place is also at threat and has been at threat for the past 30 years for oil and gas development. It is the last 5% of America's Arctic coast that's still protected. The oil companies have 95% of the coast on the North Slope. Mm-hmm. And we're trying to protect the last 5%. And that's why I'm saying, if the president of the United States is serious about climate change and has seen the dire consequences of climate change here, which I think he has seen the consequences of climate change, he needs to go further. He needs to rescind the permits to drill offshore in Alaska, and he needs to permanently protect the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge as a first step for protecting Alaska Native subsistence rights and addressing climate change.
Now, Faith, in Canada, Indigenous communities there or First Nations peoples in Canada have been on the front lines for a long time of the fight against climate change. In the U.S., over the past couple of years, that has become increasingly the case as well. How important is it for Indigenous communities here in the U.S. to lead the fight to end climate change, to end fossil fuel dependence?
I think it's very critical that we do lead the fight, because we are hit first and hit hardest, not only here in Alaska, but all across the lower 48. Tribes see the impacts, feel the impacts of climate change first and most, because we all indigenous people have a direct, close, intimate relationship with the earth, with the land. And so these impacts are seen right away, and we are raising the alarm bells that humanity is at risk. The survival of humanity is at risk, and we are taking a lead and have been taking a lead in climate discussions, whether it's at the local level, at the national level, but also at the international level. And I think that that is critical.
Well, Faith, I want to thank you so much for joining us. Where can people find out more information about the work that you do with your organization?
Right now, our website is under construction, but that will be available in the very near future. And we just have a Facebook page. We have a Twitter page. Red Oil AK is the handle.
Red Oil, REDOILAK. Faith, thank you so much for joining us, and best of luck to you.
Thank you.
Faith Gemmell is the executive director of Red Oil. That stands for Resisting Environmental Destruction on Indigenous Lands. And if you go to Facebook and search for REDOIL, you should be able to find it, or just check uprisingwithsonali.com later today. And we'll post all of the links. Any links that you hear mentioned on the air, or any stories that you hear about on the air that you want to find more links to, always go to our website. This is Uprising. Anna Buss is our assistant producer and our technical director. Christian Beck is our production coordinator. Kiana Turner is our visual editor, and Teddy Robinson is our audio engineer. Special thanks to Jonathan Alexander. Subscribe to our YouTube channel at youtube.com/uprisingwithsonali. Our website is uprisingwithsonali.com. Our theme music is by Quetzal. On Monday, we have Labor Day off, and so you'll hear a exciting rebroadcast of an older but popular program, and I'll be back live on Tuesday. I'm Sonali Kohatkar, host and executive producer of Uprising. Have a wonderful weekend.